track 12. We have two feature items for you this week, both of them from TNF Soundings. The first, which is fairly short, tells of a new campaign which asks the government to commit to five key steps to help ensure that blind and partially sighted students have better support during their time in the education system. This article has been written by Heather and is read by Amanda.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Hello. This is Amanda with an article written by Heather about a new campaign launched in October 2024, calling on the government to improve access to education for blind and partially sighted students. Called A Vision for Vision Impairment Education, the campaign is being led by the Thomas Pocklington Trust, a charity aiming to achieve equal treatment for blind and partially sighted people. The campaign asks government to act urgently on five key points that will help overcome barriers faced by blind and partially sighted students in the current education system. Government is being asked to commit to five key steps, which are ensuring the curriculum framework for children and young people with vision impairment is formally adopted, securing proper funding to support visually impaired students in further education, reviewing assistive and mainstream technology, and delivering a strategy to ensure that all visually impaired children and young people learn the relevant skills, ensuring the experiences of blind and partially sighted students are fully considered in the National Curriculum Review and in the Children's Wellbeing Bill, making the disabled students' commitment mandatory in higher education. In addition, the campaign is urging government to address problems in the special educational needs and disability system, which have left many students without the support they need. The five action points for government are based on the real-life experiences of blind and partially sighted students, such as Sarah. Sarah's vision deteriorated when she was in sixth form and she was registered as severely sight impaired. As a result, at school, Sarah had access to a specialist teacher qualified to help young people with vision impairments, and she found that really helpful. But now Sarah is at university, she's lost the specialist teacher, and that is making university life more difficult. The Thomas Pocklington Trust campaign wants to ensure that students like Sarah continue to have access to specialist support once they move to further or higher education. Without specialist support, visually impaired students like Sarah will struggle to compete on a level playing field with other sighted students.
The second article is Liz's monthly exploration of a woman most of us will not have known about. Elsie Ingalls was one of the first women to qualify as a doctor in Scotland. She later ran a hospital in Edinburgh and led a team of the Scottish Women's Hospital Group to work on the Eastern Front in Serbia during World War I. Liz tells us, a bit croakily this time, about Elsie's life and her status as a national hero in Scotland and Serbia.
Hello there, it's Liz from East Kilbride again. I'm here today to tell you all about a pioneering Scottish doctor, Elsie Maud Ingalls. Now, for all that we might claim she's famous in Scotland, she actually wasn't born in Scotland. She was born in India, in the town of Nainital, and she was a daughter of the Raj. Her father, John, was a civil servant in the Indian Empire in the late 19th century. The way the government dealt with local people annoyed her father greatly. He decided to move his family away from the hills of the Himalayas. He took them to Tasmania. That didn't work out. And by the age of 12, Elsie was back in Edinburgh, a city that she always since that time regarded as home. Her father supported her wish to be educated, and her dream of qualifying as a woman doctor. Now, it's important to say, folks, just how difficult that was at the turn of the 19th century. Men and women classes were not allowed together. You weren't allowed together to visit the wards. Women paid higher fees and faced basic hostility. In spite of that, Elsie qualified by the age of 28 and decided to move her knowledge on. She travelled to Dublin, then she travelled to London, and that's where she acquired the reputation as the fresh air doctor. Whatever was wrong with you, Dr. Ingalls wanted to put you out on the balcony for plenty of fresh air. By the age of 40, she had come back to Edinburgh to work in the area where she believed she would do most good, the poor working class area round about the High Street. It's now the tourist trail on the way to Edinburgh Castle. This is what Elsie Ingalls dedicated the next decade of her life to. From the age of 40 to the age of 50, she ran a hospital for women and children. She ordered the drugs. She dealt with the patients. She dealt with the nurses. And she worked long, long hours. She seems to have been a positive and a resolute boss. In the face of some of these struggles, one of the largest was the difficulties of dealing with whom she called tyrannical husbands. Because you see, even although a woman needed an operation, that operation needed the consent of a husband. And she didn't always get that. Her family were worried about the workload, and she promised them one more year. And then the next year was 1914. By 1914, Elsie had already decided that the way forward for British society was for women to gain the vote. She supported the suffragist movement. She never advocated violence, and her leader was a remarkable woman called Millicent Fawcett. She organised banners, marches and parades. The suffragist movement campaigned for the vote, but in August 1914, when war was declared, they transferred all their energies over to supporting the war effort. Elsie, by this time, had run a hospital for 10 years. She took along her idea for a Scottish women's hospital to the War Office. And the story is that they listened to her proposal and then they said, "Dear lady, go home and sit still. Fat chance." The organisation of suffragists decided they could put all their campaigning skills together and encourage the people of Scotland to fund a hospital. And that's what happened. Innovative ideas of fundraising, and they gathered enough money, and Elsie found that other countries would be happy to accept Scottish women and doctors and nurses, ambulance drivers and mechanics, and they set out to the Western Front. Beyond that, there was great need on the Eastern Front. And that's why she found herself in Serbia by the spring of 1916. The conditions were dire. Here are Elsie's own words. "These poor little people, the Serbians, you cannot imagine anything more miserable than they are. They've been fighting for years for their independence, and now it seems it's all to end. There'll be famine soon, as well as cold, in this corner of the world. The women were taken prisoner, gave such great care to their enemies that they were then cared for by the other side. In February 1916, Elsie's health was starting to suffer and she was sent home. In recognition of her work in Serbia, she was awarded the Order of the White Eagle by the Serbian government. She cared for her staff, organising amusements, dances, fancy dress, obstacle races and other competitions. But the need came clear. Elsie would have to return to Serbia for another session among the forces. "You can't imagine," she wrote to her sister, "how many wounded we have. 11,000, and only one of them a surgeon. So we just turned up our sleeves and we went in." She managed to find humour even in these dire circumstances. Here's an anecdote for you. "There's rivalry, I hear, between the armoured car men and the British Red Cross men about the capabilities of the different nursing sisters. Our sisters are so smart that they get a man on the operating table 5 minutes after the first one went off. That's nothing," the other group said. "The Scottish sisters get the second man on before the first one comes off." By 1917, Elsie is returning to Scotland again. 1917 was also the year of the Russian Revolution. The journey home was horrendous. Long delays, long diversions. But in November 1917, she and her team are approaching Britain. She sends a telegram to her family. "All are well, except me." Elsie Ingalls dies one day after landing in Britain in November 1917, well before women of any category were awarded the vote. By this time, she was a national hero in Scotland. A funeral service was held in St Giles Cathedral. Winston Churchill attended, and the Serbian officers carried her coffin through the streets of Edinburgh down to the last stage of the funeral at the Dean Cemetery. Now, I don't want to just finish there, because Elsie was not forgotten about. The people of Serbia regarded her almost as a saint. And when I visited Serbia many, many years later, I was stunned by the number of Elsie Ingalls roads, schools and indeed hospitals. The main hospital in Belgrade was named after Elsie. Edinburgh also showed their recognition of Elsie. And in 1925, the Elsie Ingalls Memorial Hospital, full of lovely balconies, full of lovely modern facilities, was opened for the women and the children of Edinburgh. In the decades that followed, many folk no longer heard about Elsie Ingalls and her work. But she has become better known in recent years. In 2015, the British Embassy in Belgrade was renamed the Elsie Ingalls House. And she's there on the Serbian stamps in recognition of her work. In Scotland, in recognition of the 100 years since her death, her gravestone was restored and a memorial service was held in St Giles Cathedral. And then you might remember the Beaches tribute in 1918 to significant folk who had been through World War I. And here in Scotland, on the West Sands beach at St Andrews, there was an image of Elsie Ingalls. And last, to tell you the image that might have meant so much to her. There has been a statue to Emmeline Pankhurst for many, many years. But finally, in 2018, a statue was unveiled to Elsie's leader, Millicent Fawcett, the leader of the National Union of Women's Suffrage Societies. And that statue has quite a large plinth, and on that plinth, Elsie Ingalls is named as one of the pioneers in the struggle for women's suffrage. So to end, I'll leave you with this question. Do public statues matter? Do we need to see important people who have perhaps been forgotten now rediscovered and put on plinths in the streets? Well, there's something you can be thinking about. But thank you so much for listening and hopefully enjoying this life of such a pioneering, important figure, Elsie Maud Ingalls.
TNF Soundings.